Hello and welcome to this palliative care podcast from the End of Life Partnership in collaboration with East Cheshire NHS Trust and East Cheshire Hospice, entitled Helping Last Days of Life at Home, a guide for GPs and other healthcare professionals working in primary care. The podcast is delivered by Dr. Catherine Gaunt, palliative care consultant at East Cheshire NHS Trust, and Dr. Louise Jackson, GP at Knutsford Medical Partnership. The podcast follows a case study approach, which contains information relating to guidance and documentation used at end of life, which will hopefully improve your knowledge, skills and confidence in this area. At the end of the podcast, a list of useful websites and contact details will be given to support you in your practice.
Hello and welcome to a palliative care podcast. So my name is Catherine Gaunt. I'm a palliative care consultant working in East Cheshire. And we decided that it'd be really helpful to put a podcast together for you just to think about the issues that might arise when you're trying to care for a dying patient at home. So we're going to outline all the key things that you need to think about during this podcast to try and help somebody have the best death that they can possibly have at home. And I'm really pleased to welcome a special guest today who's going to help talk us through this podcast. So we've got Dr. Louise Jackson, who's a GP working in East Cheshire.
Hello.
And Louise is also a specialty doctor working at East Cheshire Hospice and has got lots of palliative care experience. So I think it would be really helpful, Louise, just to have a think about some common scenarios for patients that you may have looked after in that dying phase at home. And I think there's one person in particular that you just wanted to talk to us about today.
I picked this one because I think as GPs, sometimes dealing with end-of-life care at home for chronic disease management, the elderly and the frail, is quite difficult. Their path through their illness isn't always quite as predictable as a cancer-related decline, and I think GPs worry about doing the right thing at the varying stages. So I thought I'd pick a case that I've seen in relative recent times of an 80-year-old man with Alzheimer's that lives with his wife.
Okay, tell us some more.
So I was literally doing an afternoon triage session, coming towards the end of my triage session, so it's probably about 4:30, 5 o'clock in the afternoon.
Typical.
When reception called to say that they had a lady requesting a home visit for her husband. So on calling the lady, she's called Maureen and her husband is Sydney. Sydney's an 80-year-old man. He's got quite advanced dementia and has been living at home with his wife. They've been coping quite well, but she was very distressed. She was telling me she can't get him out of bed, he's not eating. She'd had to change his bed sheets 3 or 4 times already in the day because he's wetting himself.
Okay.
And she sort of ended by saying, please don't send us back into that place. And she was talking about the hospital. She said the weekend doctor did that and she didn't want to go back into hospital.
Okay.
So
you've got... you're busy, end of the day, and you've got this phone call from quite a distressed elderly woman, and she's asking for a visit, I presume, or you're thinking you're probably going to need to go out and see what's going on with poor Sydney. So what do you want, I suppose, what sort of information do you have available to you to I guess work out what could be happening here and what you're going to be faced with when you go out to the home, and what kind of conversations might you be needing to have with them?
So I guess in East Cheshire we have the EMIS record, which the district nurses and everybody can be, and the specialist palliative care team is involved, can feed into, so we can access records all around. So actually I'm sitting in that privileged position of being able to see his recent history and what's been going on with him.
Okay.
And I think sort of before I go out and do any visit like this, I think information is really important about how things have been going. So I had a look through his records We'd had about 3 or 4 acute admissions over the last year with sepsis, UTI, off legs.
Yeah, okay.
And had been discharged back home. There wasn't very much information about how he was when he was discharged back home in the system. It's also interested in whether, bearing in mind somebody's got, in essence, a terminal illness like dementia, whether any advanced life care planning decisions had been made for him, either at any stage or when he had capacity, but there was no evidence that any conversations had taken place.
Okay, so I guess in East Cheshire, we tend to use the EPACS record, don't we? So that's the Electronic Palliative Care Coordination System. And that's been in use now in East Cheshire for quite a number of years. And it is, again, it's all linked up with the EMIS record. Mm-hmm. So it's a particular template that you can access through EMIS. And it allows healthcare professionals to, once they've had advanced care planning conversations with patients or families potentially about a patient's wishes, who patients who have felt to probably be in those last that last year of life and may have specific wishes about their care, for instance, whether they want readmissions back into hospital, decisions around resuscitation, other decisions around escalations of treatment, decisions around where they would want to be at the end of their life. All of that is documented in one place on the EPACS template. And actually, it sounds like that could have been a really helpful thing.
If it had been
completed. But from what you're telling me, there was sadly no EPACS record for Sydney.
And they weren't particularly known to any single GP in the practice, so that's possibly poor planning from our side in primary care.
Okay.
So prior to the visit, I basically had gained information basically just on admissions and his diagnosis, but didn't really have that much more information on top of that.
Was there anything around his baseline, what he was managing to do day to day, or was he up and about? Was he in bed, chair? Was he looking after his own sort of personal care needs? Did you have any of that sort of information?
No, and they weren't known to the district nurses either, so there was nothing I could glean from the district nurse entries in the notes either.
Okay. Because I guess that sort of information about baseline function, particularly in the frail elderly patients, often with dementia or other comorbidities, it can be really helpful. And there is, on the Gold Standards Framework website, there is some proactive indicator guidance, which helps you to maybe look at those sorts of indicators for function, but also for the specific illnesses such as cancer or heart failure, COPD, dementia, the types of things that you might want to be looking out for that might prompt you to think, actually, this patient could well be in the last year of life, and things like advanced care planning, EPACS record, making sure that they're on your practice gold standards framework list so they get discussed at the meetings. All of those things, it can prompt you to think about all of those things. But it sounds like you were lacking a bit of that information, sadly. So what did you do next?
So I went out to see him. When I arrived, Maureen was really upset. He was in bed upstairs. When I went into the room, he opened his eyes and I said hello, but there wasn't really any conversation. There was this a UTI type smell in the room, as if he had an infection. And sort of clinically, he was showing all the signs of sepsis, so his temperature was high at 38, he was tachycardic at 110, his respiratory rate was up slightly, and he was hypotensive, and he had an uncomfortable, palpable bladder.
Oh, gosh. Okay. So you're thinking you've got a septic elderly man in front of you. What's the first instinct?
So I think the first instinct when you're doing home visits is that actually if they're septic, you admit them.
Yeah.
But then actually when you look at the bigger picture and listen to Maureen as she's talking to you about Sydney, I think you have to consider that an admission might not be the right thing, and looking at the fact that he'd been in and out of hospital with no apparent improvements other than causing agitation and upset to him, according to Maureen, that actually an admission might not be in this gentleman's best interest.
Yeah, and I presume you could get a better sense of his baseline as well once he was out, once you were out there.
Yeah.
And what sort of information was Maureen able to tell you about that and about his, you know, any discussions or thoughts she'd had?
She was basically very clear that although they'd never written anything down or formalised any advanced life care plans or wishes, that actually they had an opportunity to talk to each other, and she'd had an opportunity to talk with her family, and that Sydney always wanted to stay at home.
Okay.
And I think as time had gone on and she'd seen the disruption of an acute admission and how agitated he became with that reinforced to her.
Yeah.
And perhaps was the reason why she didn't call earlier, because she was worried that somebody might bounce him into hospital.
Again, yeah. Okay, so how did you feel? Because obviously you've got a clearly septic man who's not got capacity to make decisions for himself. How did you feel? Because this is obviously a best interest decision that's needing to be made here for Sydney, because we don't have any advance decisions to refuse treatment or any clear escalation plans that have been discussed with him. So, and obviously you've got Maureen's telling you that she wouldn't want him to go back into hospital. But in terms of a best interest decision, how did you feel about that?
I think anybody walking into that situation, they'd feel uncomfortable with it, because actually, if you decide not to admit him in that situation, there's a high possibility that he's going to die.
Yeah.
And I think we all need the reassurance of those discussions having been formalised prior to events to feel 100% comfortable.
Yeah.
But I think if anybody, a GP that has a full record in front of them and has some knowledge, although minimal, of a family and their consulting behaviours, would be in the best position in that situation to have those conversations.
Who else could you involve in the decision making, I guess?
So they had a daughter.
Oh, okay.
And I did actually offer to call the daughter to see whether that would be appropriate to involve in the conversation, and Maureen was quite happy that she would speak to the daughter.
Okay. Because I guess that's important, that you don't have maybe conflict within the family, because that may make the decision making much more challenging if certain family members are wanting certain interventions and others aren't. But it sounds like in this case there was consensus, which is helpful.
And we didn't have any record of any history of conflict within the family in the notes. You also have the opportunity that, you know, if he's still taking sips, although he's very, very poorly, that you can offer to the family that you could try an oral antibiotic and maximise good medical care in the home.
Yeah.
And actually being realistic, accepting that this might be a terminal event, that he dies from his sepsis, that you're actually still giving him a maximum chance in his place, preferred place of care, to see how he can respond to that.
Yeah.
And I think that helps the doctor feel slightly more comfortable and the family feel slightly more comfortable with the decision. So that helps.
So I guess the decision that you made in conjunction with Maureen was to keep Sydney at home, to try and encourage him with oral antibiotics and fluids as much as he was able to do. But obviously you needed to make it clear to Maureen that by him staying at home, there's a strong possibility that he wouldn't survive this episode and that he may actually be in the last days of life. And I think that's a very important part of the conversation, isn't it? When we're going out and we're making treatment plans, discussing the likeliest outcomes or even the possible outcomes being that somebody is likely to die. because I think without that frank discussion, then you leave families and relatives in the position of not knowing what to do if they decline, potentially thinking they ought to be calling somebody else out, calling emergency paramedics, for instance. But I think from what you've said, the importance of discussing the uncertainty of it, yes, as well.
It is. And Maureen made that slightly easier because she'd been round this circle of admissions and being aware of what a hospital could offer that we couldn't offer in the home, and weighing that up against his previous agitations and disruption. At being admitted, she felt very strongly that this was the right thing for him.
Okay.
So having made that decision, we then had at sort of 5:30 in the evening a little bit of an uphill battle to do probably what should have been a year's worth of advanced landing care planning.
And it's typical, and it's always, I bet it was a Friday as well.
I can't remember what, no, because I work here on a Friday.
Oh, yeah.
So again, I offered to speak to the family, so they were aware of what we were planning, and she still declined. I very often, when I go out to do visits where I think this might be a conversation we need to have, will actually go out with an anticipatory medication blue booklet and,
okay, yeah,
and a unified DNA CPR form and a district nurse verification of death.
So had you done that with this, with Sydney's case? Had you come prepared?
I had, yeah.
Oh, very good.
Because of having spoken to Maureen, I knew that this was possibly an option that we were going to be facing.
Should we just talk through each of those things, just to clarify what each of those things are that you mentioned? So you obviously mentioned the unified DNA CPR form, so... In East Cheshire, we use the LILAC form, which is obviously called the Unified DNA CPR form. And that should travel with the patient, shouldn't it? So it stays, the top copy stays with the patient, and it travels with the patient wherever they go, whether that's into hospital, care homes, hospice. And for that reason, that it stays with the patient, it's clearly really important that they understand what that means and that the discussion has been had with them if they're able to, and that they're involved in that decision and that discussion. But if they obviously don't have capacity like Sydney, and you're making that decision in his best interests, then it's important that we share that information with his next of kin, which was Maureen. And you also mentioned the blue booklet. Yeah. So that's the anticipatory prescribing booklet that we use in East Cheshire. And it's been around in East Cheshire now, again, for quite a number of years, but it was reviewed relatively recently, back in 2018. And at that stage, we made some changes to the anticipatory drugs that we use in the last days of life. So I'll just run through quickly what those four medications are. So we use morphine as our first line injectable opioid for pain and breathlessness. We use midazolam for agitation. We use levomepromazine as a first line antiemetic for nausea and vomiting at the end of life. And the reason we use levomepromazine is that it's a broad spectrum antiemetic, so it works on many different receptors that can cause nausea and vomiting. And we know at the end of someone's life that it's often very hard to pinpoint exactly what the cause of their nausea and vomiting is, so it's often a very good way of ensuring good symptom control. But saying that, if somebody's very settled and very controlled on a different antiemetic, maybe cyclozine, metoclopramide, and you actually want to convert that into an injectable form, for instance, in the last days of life, that's perfectly reasonable. And then finally, we use glycopyrronium, which we use to help dry up respiratory tract secretions for somebody who maybe has excessive secretions and noisy breathing at the end of life. And we suggest some doses, and a lot of the doses are pre-printed within the blue booklet, but we do ask you to make sure that those doses are appropriate when you're prescribing them, and you will need to prescribe the dose of opiates, because some patients will require different doses, particularly if they're already on an opiate. It's important that they have the appropriate breakthrough dose. And there's lots of guidelines around prescribing, and particularly for people who may be already on opiates, there's flowcharts that you can find at the back of the blue booklet, and there's also opiate conversion charts that you can find as well. So all of that can be really helpful, because obviously we work in palliative care, but maybe looking after a dying person at home is not, it's not an every week occurrence or every month occurrence. So if you need any guidance or assistance, or just want to talk through any medication prescribing or any support, then the specialist palliative care team are there to help.
And as GPs as well, the district nurses need us to prescribe the water for the mixing and the making
of these medications
as well. So EMIS will prompt you with that, and the blue book will as well.
Yeah, particularly if they're needing a syringe pump, then they would need water for injection. And just a quick, whilst we're on blue booklets, just a quick thought about syringe pumps, because I know there's been debate around, obviously we encourage that PRN medications are prescribed in anticipation, so in advance of somebody requiring them. And there's been lots of discussion and debate as to whether we should be prescribing syringe pumps in advance as well. The current guidelines we state, and they are there and in the blue booklet, is that ideally syringe pumps should be prescribed at the point of need, because it's very hard to predict what dose and what medication somebody might need. And particularly with opiates, we see opiate dosing change often quite frequently in those last days of life, not necessarily for the frail elderly patients like Sydney, but maybe more for the younger patients, maybe the cancer patients. They can have escalating doses, and it may be that a dose that you prescribed a week ago is no longer appropriate. So wherever possible, please do prescribe syringe pumps at the point of need. And then you mentioned about the nurse verification form as well, which we've just had an update on the nurse verification form. So you've always before completed a paper document, is that right?
Yeah, that gets left in the home.
And that allows for the district nurses, if they've got the competencies to do so, to verify an expected death. And that allows the family to have that verification happen in a timely way, and not necessarily having to wait for an out of hours GP to be able to find the time to be able to come out and do that. But just within the last few weeks, there's been a change to the nurse verification policy in East Cheshire. So we no longer need to use the form, the paper document. But what we're advising now is that the last days of life template is used on EMIS. So this is another EMIS template. It's separate to the EPACS template, but they do speak to each other. So if you've completed something on one, then, and it's the same thing, such as DNA CPR, then it will speak to the other template and pull it over. But the last days of life template basically means that you as a GP feel that this person is in the last days of life.
And that you've had that conversation with the family,
and that you don't think there's anything reversible or treatable, and that you're anticipating that they will die within days. And then there are certain things that you just need to agree to or tick on the last days of life template. And one of those is that you would agree to a nurse verifying the death, because it's an expected death, and it's just literally a tick box, so no more forms to fill in, just click on a box. There's actually five boxes that we ask GPs to tick, just basically to say yes, this person is dying, and that you've considered reversible causes, and that you've thought about unified DNA CPR, blue booklet medicines, and all of those things. And actually, it's once you've then as a GP completed that, then the district nurses have got a different template that they then use to make sure that all the person's care in the last days of life is meeting the five priorities for care. So you looked at me a little bit unsure, Louise.
Just thinking about the five priorities of care.
Well, I know you know what they are, but maybe I should just go through what they are. So the five priorities of care, rather than a national document around how we should be caring for the dying, we've now got five priorities that we can use to generate our own sort of local approach, I guess, to caring for dying people. And those five priorities are around recognising dying, around communicating dying, around making sure that the patient and the family are as involved as much as they'd like to, that we offer the correct support to them, and that we pull it all together with an individualised plan of care, which is what the Last Days of Life template is, essentially. So just a plug, really, to think about using that Last Days of Life template. And I know that it may be that you don't know how to access it, or you don't know exactly where it is on your EMIS system. But what we'll do at the end of the podcast is just give you some contacts and some information on where you can get more information on what we've talked about, and where you can get advice and support as well. So you've talked about those three things. Is there anything else that you needed to do for Sydney?
Yeah, so before I left, we discussed with Maureen about managing his, trying the antibiotics, which we mentioned, if he can manage them. Managing his discomfort from his bladder.
He's in urinary retention.
So I spoke to the district nursing team, and the night on-call team came and catheterised him as one of their first calls.
Okay. Even though you weren't concerned about the fact that he had infection on board?
We discussed that, and okay. I've mentioned that ideally we wouldn't catheterise somebody but with infection, because it can make it worse. But accepting where we were with Sydney, and that actually his overall priority was being at home, to make that possible, to be at home with Maureen, that was really the only option we had, and also to manage his discomfort. And the district nurses going to do that also means that they can then carry out an assessment. So actually, if things plateau out with Sydney, then at least the district nurses know about Sydney and can hand over to the day team, and that method of assessment can carry on.
And I suppose you've got the district nurses involved, and they're the key people now, aren't they, really, to be assessing his comfort and making sure that he's got the right equipment in place. What kind of care might Sydney and Maureen need? And do you know of any other support agencies that might be able to help Maureen and Sydney during this time?
So the district nurses are really good at the sort of medical assessment and managing symptoms, but don't have the capacity to be able to provide social hands-on care for Sydney. And so we had a conversation about hospice at home, and made a referral through to hospice at home the following morning.
Okay.
And also the district nurses would pick up in the day team regarding his social care needs and whether a package of care needs to be arranged and put in place. So from that perspective, I think that's all I could do, really, at that time in the evening.
And I think, obviously, you're coming towards an evening. It's not a Friday, as we've discussed, but you're coming to an out-of-hours period. So I guess you want to maybe share some of that decision-making with the teams that are going to be taking over out-of-hours.
So when I went back to the surgery, there's an out-of-hours notification form that we raise as GPs, and that can create a sort of a special care note that basically lets out-of-hours know that this is a gentleman at home who's deteriorating, and if he dies, it's an expected death.
Okay.
That can only be done at the surgery, because it has to be populated and emailed over so that the information is there for them. It can't be handwritten.
Okay.
and also going back to the surgery and being a really good GP and populating EPACs and opening up the last days of life templates. Those templates will also, when you tick that you're placing anticipatory drugs in the home, when you close the template down, will give you all the options for generating your prescription as well.
That's very clever.
And that can now be sent electronically. So if you've got a late pharmacy, you can send it to a late pharmacy to be generated. Sometimes the district nurses will aid in getting those medicines to the home. At other times, very often, you'll have a relative or a supportive neighbour that might go and pick up that prescription to take it into the home.
And just a thought on medications. There are specific pharmacies within East Cheshire that hold the end-of-life medications. Yeah. So those can be found on the Cheshire e-page, yeah, which we'll give you the details for at the end. And there's a list of the Cheshire pharmacies on there that hold those end-of-life medications. But I know that the East Cheshire Hospice as well would always be happy through their advice line, yeah, to be able to give that sort of information as well. So you've had to do quite a lot of work.
It was a busy evening on call.
What time was it by the time you'd finished that?
A visit like this, you can be in the home for up to an hour by the time, yeah, you've supported assessed a patient, supported, because very often it's the relative that needs, yeah, the support. And you've discussed through paperwork and everything, and then actually it can be another sort of half an hour back at the surgery coordinating all the templates and the bits of paper.
Yeah, true.
So in all honesty, I can see why GPs go look at the observations, and after that, GP would potentially, if very, very pushed for time, find that that's all too much to do on a visit. And yeah, you can see why people without advanced life care planning get admitted to, yeah, hospital acutely.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas actually a big chunk of your job would have been done already if there'd been any discussions, wouldn't it, yeah, with him, maybe when he had capacity, or certainly with the family as well.
The other really big thing as well, particularly for a lot of GPs that work part-time like I do, is making sure that you've got an appropriate follow-up for the next day. So that you hand it over to a GP. In an ideal world, you'd partner up with a GP that is in when you're not, or make sure you visit the next day and that you hand it over to the team that will be looking after him the next day.
And what happened then in the end with Sydney?
Well, interestingly, with all the advanced life care planning, he actually managed to take 24 hours of antibiotics and started to improve.
Did he?
So that's another huge fear for GPs, that actually you make all these decisions and have the big conversations that, yeah, that I'm expecting that he might die in the next few hours or the next couple of days, and then in a Lazarus style, they recover.
They make you look like fools.
They prove you wrong, and you worry that will then affect your relationship moving forward with the family because they can't trust you. But actually, I think that's really something we hold in our heads as a worry, because I think families appreciate the open, honest discussions that we don't have all the answers, but actually we can prepare for the worst.
Yes, and you'd sort of sowed that seed of uncertainty, haven't you,
yeah,
with Maureen?
Yeah.
So he's still alive, is he, Sydney?
He is, with more care going,
okay,
in to help Maureen, and he's deteriorating. And I wouldn't be surprised if the next infection is the next, but at least all the advanced life care planning is now.
So is it still appropriately has that blue booklet, do you think, in the house?
Definitely. So he's now because he's still very frail and very susceptible to decline, and I wouldn't be surprised if that happened tomorrow, next week.
So you're still thinking, yeah, probably last week's.
And the blue book would need reviewing every 3 months anyway,
yeah.
So there would be a point at which, if in a busy day-to-day working as a GP, that was for any reason overlooked, that it would come up for review anyway.
Yeah. So we wouldn't suggest that blue booklets stay in somebody's house for months and months on end. Again, it may well be that their needs are different, that the drugs are no longer appropriate. and actually that it would be appropriate for some patients, I'm not necessarily saying Sydney, but for some patients if they deteriorated and the situation had changed, that they actually needed active treatment and actually going into hospital. Yeah. And so it is important that those blue booklets, if they're not used and the situation changes, that they do get reviewed every 3 months.
And I think as GPs, the big thing is not to be frightened that if you start on that last days of life template, you can always stop it.
Of course, it's
not a disaster if a patient doesn't die. It's actually a very positive thing. So you've got nothing to lose by making all the preparations.
So I guess in summary, that's a really interesting case, and I think it's a case that is actually really quite common, but it's not maybe something that we talk about in teaching sessions quite so much, is it? So I think it's a good one to highlight. What are the key things that you'd think, I suppose, want other GPs to get from having discussed this case?
From my perspective, that although we picked dementia today, this could be a case of someone who's had recurrent admissions for end-stage heart failure or end-stage respiratory disease, and none of these chronic disease conditions differ, really. And I know we're battling against time the whole time, but that stitch in time saving 9 really is true, that actually if you can get your care coordinators in the surgery, who might call people up post-discharge from hospital, to even just touch upon, you know, whether there's anything from the admission they'd like to discuss, or after a discharge, if you've got a good relationship with the patient probably thought they were going to die in hospital anyway, so you've not got anything to lose by starting to have these conversations about what patients want. Very often they're relieved that somebody is
talking about the elephant in the room.
Yeah, talking about what they're worried about.
Yeah.
I think the big learning is bedside care planning really does have a role, and a lot more people will manage to achieve their preferred place of death and care in the home if we're just slightly more confident about having these conversations.
Yeah. That's really helpful. And I guess as a summary of the kinds of things that you need to be thinking about as a GP when you are preparing for somebody to be in those last days of life at home, it's that unified DNA CPR, it's that blue booklet, those blue booklet medications, it's making sure that you've used that last days of life template, and you've obviously informed the out of hours GPs, and that you've involved the district nurses and thought about any other care agencies that might be helpful as well.
Yeah.
So I think that's everything, Louise. And thank you so much for bringing that case and for being part of the podcast. And who knows, we might be doing some more soon.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
For further help and advice, please visit Cheshire ePage at www.cheshire-epage.nhs.uk, where you'll find a repository of useful information and resources pertaining to palliative and end-of-life care. Or contact the East Cheshire Specialist Palliative Care Team on 01625 663177, or each individual hub in South and Vale Royal, dependent on where you work. Crew Hub on 01270 278420, Nantwich and Rural 01270 278430, Smash on 01270 278440, or Northwich 01606 564 134. Also, 24-hour hospice advice line is available for East Cheshire Hospice on 01625 666 999, or St Luke's Hospice on 01606 555 489. For further information on education and training, please contact the End of Life Partnership at www.eolp.org.uk or by telephone on 01270 310 260. Thank you.